the Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia. Oyez, oyez, oyez. Silence is commanded on pain of imprisonment while the Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia are sitting. All persons having business with this court will draw near and give their attention. Any having pleas to enter or suits to prosecute, let them come forward and they shall be heard. God save the Commonwealth and this Honorable Court.
The clerk will call the first case.
Hooked Group, LLC versus City of Chesapeake. L. Stephen Emmert, Joshua E. Baker, Blake A. Willis, Appellant's Counsel, Jacob P. Stroman, City Attorney, Kelly Lackey, Deputy City Attorney, Ellen F. Bergren, Assistant City Attorney, Kelly D. Sheeran, Assistant City Attorney, Appellee's Counsel. Mr. Emmert, can you hear me?
I can.
Ms. Bergren, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Chief Justice Lemons, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Goodwin, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Mims, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Powell, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Kelsey, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice McCullough, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Chafin, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Mr. Chief Justice, the parties are present and ready to begin.
Mr. Emmert, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I'm Steve Emmert, and I represent the landowner in this inverse condemnation appeal. This court has repeatedly held that a locality's invocation of the phrase police power is not a get-out-of-liability-free card in an inverse condemnation context. When a municipal act extinguishes all of an abutting owner's access to a road, that can be a compensable taking. The city asks you to narrow this rule out of existence, saying essentially only when remaining property loses access to all roads. The trial court has already risen to this bait, ruling essentially that because you have access to Road X, the closure of Road Y doesn't harm you as a matter of law. That's not what your decisions say, and for those holdings to retain vitality, this judgment needs to be reversed. Being sensible, I'm going to start with the city's Achilles heel, which is the Denison case. You've seen the maps from that record in the addendum to our briefs, and you can, and I request that you do, take judicial notice of them since they're part of your records of your court. The Denison property fronted on two roads. The commissioner shut off all access to one of them, just like what happened here. This court ruled in that case that the issue of residue damages was for the jury. Well, actually, with the commissioners, the condemnation commissioners, but now we have jurors. And that's how this case should have proceeded. Instead, the trial court took the issue away from the jury, again saying remaining access is reasonable as a matter of law. Confronted with this problem, the city has hastily invented a rationalization that you've seen now in their briefs on the merits, the major road versus minor road distinction. The court will search in vain for any court that has recognized such a rule as this. It appears to have been a product of the necessity of this case to invent one. Assuming for argument's sake that there were such a rule, then it, like its inverse, which presented itself in Denison, presents a jury question of what the remaining access is. This court has always respected the jury's role. You recently described it as the democratical balance in the judiciary power and noted that the citizenry possesses a share of the judicature that they have reserved for themselves. The trial court was wrong to take that right away, a right that belongs to both the citizens and the Hooked Group in this case. This court should direct that a jury, not a judge, makes this call. I have leave to respond in the time remaining.
Yes. 12:35. Ms. Bergman, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. Ellen Bergman, Deputy City Attorney, on behalf of the City of Chesapeake. It's my great pleasure to be speaking with you today. Your Honor, this is a police power case. And this case falls squarely within established Virginia Supreme Court precedent, Wood versus City of Richmond. The city closed a portion of Callison Drive after a public hearing. There were citizens that were concerned with a proposed commercial development, and they that would interfere with their quiet residential neighborhood. And the city council struck a balance between that commercial development and protecting the integrity of a residentially zoned neighborhood situated directly behind it. The city exercised its police power to close 250 feet, only a portion of Callison Drive, which was a secondary dead-end road that abutted the rear of Hook Group's property, to promote traffic safety for the public and to regulate any commercial traffic that may exit that directly into that residential neighborhood. If the Supreme Court were to adopt the rule that Hook Group is advancing, municipalities all over the Commonwealth will be subject to inverse condemnation suits each time they close an access point to regulate traffic in pursuit of public safety, even if reasonable right-of-way access remains on that property. Here, the trial court correctly sustained the city's demur. Hook Group failed to aver that after the Callison Drive closure, it no longer had reasonable access. And State Highway Commissioner versus Easley, this court held that an owner of property abutting a public road has no right to compensation when a locality, pursuant to its police powers, reasonably regulates the flow of traffic. In Denison, which is the case that Mr. Emmert has spoken about, the court also articulated that rule, stating that the owner of land abutting a public highway is only entitled to reasonable access to his property, and those rights are subordinate to the right of the state to control traffic. In Lindsley, this court held that a reduction or limitation of direct access to an abutting landowner's property is generally not compensable. And that phrase is important because it directly links access to the property, reasonable access to the property. There could be more than one access point. And based on these cases, when a landowner alleges that a locality has limited or restricted its access to a parcel, when regulating traffic, it must also demonstrate that it was left with unreasonable access. That has always been the rule. And under Easley, it's the landowner's burden to demonstrate that the remaining access is unreasonable. And Callison Drive's partial closure was to regulate the flow of commercial traffic. In its petition for declaratory judgment, Hook Group never pled that its remaining access after the partial closure was unreasonable. It's not there. Nor could it plead that, because it admitted in its petition that it had direct access to a four-lane major thoroughfare in Chesapeake, Battlefield Boulevard, Route 168. In fact, the first time that Hook ever raised an unreasonable access argument was in its brief in opposition to the demur. However, a brief is not a pleading, and you cannot correct factual deficiencies in your complaint by raising it in a brief. In Ted Lansing versus Royal Aluminum, this court held that a trial court cannot enter judgment based upon facts that were not alleged or a theory of relief that was not raised in the pleadings. In that case, the court reversed the trial court who entered judgment on a party who pursued a theory of implied warranty, but it only pled a theory of express warranty. And the trial court held that a court cannot enter judgment on a case that's different from what's pled in the pleadings. And here, Hook Group never averred that its remaining access was unreasonable under Easley and its progeny. And the trial court sitting in Chesapeake is able to take judicial notice of geographical facts, matters that are of common knowledge in its jurisdiction. That authority is Hart versus Commonwealth and Williams versus Commonwealth. In Hook's pleading, the trial court had noticed that the property had frontage on Battlefield Boulevard, and Hook never pled in its petition that remaining access was unreasonable. In addition, the trial court had noticed through the city's ordinance, which is part of the appendix here at JA 28, that the portion of Callison Drive that was closed was not in use and had been chained for many years. So for these reasons, the trial court properly sustained the city's demur on the basis that Hook had failed to plead unreasonable access and would be unable to cure that deficiency in its pleading because it had admitted frontage to access to Battlefield Boulevard and Route 168, a major Chesapeake thoroughfare. And Mr. Emmert did raise the idea that this was a question of fact. Here, access remained to a four-lane highway. The closed access point was a chained access point on a dead-end secondary street that had been closed for years. So even if the court were to reach the question of unreasonable...
Counsel? Yes. This is Justice Mims. Does the record reflect whether there is any impaired value from a development perspective if you have one access point versus two access points?
The only reference in the record to impaired value is in the petition itself. There is no evidence of that in the actual record.
Well, counsel, if on demurrer, if it's alleged in the petition for purposes of a demurrer, don't we have to accept that as fact at this stage of the plea of the case?
Well, Your Honor, it would be up to Hooks to make that argument and to advance the argument of lost access. And in this argument, when they argued on demurrer, they talked about unreasonable access. They did not...
Well, counsel, on demurrer, aren't there pleadings before the trial court, and the trial court takes notice of those pleadings and accepts them as factual?
Yes, Your Honor, they do. But here, they were required to plead unreasonable access, and they failed to plead that. And so the city can have a regulation that affects access to a property that
Counsel, educate me here. If one alleges impaired value, does that not indicate potentially an unreasonableness to the governmental action? And I'm not reaching that conclusion. I'm simply looking at the pleadings based upon our precedents. Is it not unreasonable to, for example, take 95% of the value from a piece of property? And I'm not presuming it's 95% here, but I'm saying that for purposes of a rule of law, it cannot impaired value be unreasonable?
Impaired value can go to the damaging of the property. And here, the allegation is only that Hook Group was deprived of an ingress-egress easement. That is the only property right that Hook Group alleges. There is no taking of the fee of this property. It was not subject to an incident or a road project. The only allegation is that the closure, the regulation, deprived them of a property interest. And here, you have to determine first, as a matter of law, whether or not that's a damaging of the property. There are regulations, police power regulations, and traffic regulations, where the allegation is due, for example, with circuitous access in our case, that an owner can make an allegation that the circuitous access damages access to his property, and that has a material effect on his property. But that is not sufficient as a matter of law. One has to also argue that after the exercise of the police power, that there remains unreasonable access. And that's what happened here. Hook Group also failed to allege a material impairment, and they never pled that the closure of Callison Drive was a material impairment. They have raised those arguments on appeal and the 2012 constitutional amendments, but they didn't plead it below, and they didn't argue it below. The first time Hook actually mentioned the 2012 amendments was in a perfunctory footnote in its motion to reconsider. The first time it actually meaningfully pursued this argument is on appeal, and that is barred by Supreme Court Rule 525. A passing reference in a footnote is not sufficient preserve an issue on appeal. Although this court in Brandon v. Cox did state that a party can preserve an argument and appeal by putting it in its motion for reconsideration, This court has always focused on whether the trial court had an opportunity to intelligently rule upon the issue. And this court has stated in Jackson versus Chesapeake that the real issue is whether the trial judge understands the precise question before it. Raising this in a footnote in a perfunctory manner did not put this trial court in a position to start analyzing the impact of the 2012 amendment on the case law that existed prior to its enactment. In Sing Song versus Commonwealth, the Virginia Court of Appeals held that a footnote in a pretrial brief stating that the defendant had grave concerns about his prosecution, that was insufficient to preserve his Eighth Amendment claim on appeal based on a cruel and unusual punishment. The trial judge must know the particular point that's being made. And if there's no ruling by the trial court on the issue, there's no basis to review it on appeal. Hook Group's footnote was an observation, not an argument. Thus, Hook Group did not preserve the issue of the impact of the 2012 amendments on this case and on the existing case law. But let's return to the substance of what was actually litigated before the court. This was an exercise of police power when it closed Callison Drive, not the exercise in the power of eminent domain. This case is virtually identical and sits on all fours with Wood. There was no acquisition of any land. There was no incident. It was not incident to a road project. It sat in a corner lot with a gas station abutted by two separate roads. The driveways were 34th Street and Lee Street, and the city sought to close Lee Street. And the public works director filed an affidavit saying that the driveway going over 34th Street into the gas station was a menace to the traveling public. And the landowner there made the same argument that they were able to have an unrestricted access. And that right in that case in Wood stated that it was subordinate to the right of the municipality. I wanted to briefly turn to Dennison to address Mr. Emmert's point. That case was not an inverse condemnation case. In that case, reasonable access was a factual question that arose out of an award of just compensation. Here, Hooked was required to plead facts to show in a declaratory judgment action that there was an actual damage of the property. And that gets back to Justice Mims' question about whether or not you can look to that damage. You have to first find that there's a damage. And in order to find that there's a damage, the court has to determine whether or not there is remaining access. And that was not an argument, unreasonable access, and that was not an argument advanced by Hook Group in its petition. And finally, the impact of the Lindley case and also the Easley case in Lanier Farm, those cases say an abutting road because both of those cases in Lindley and Lanier Farm dealt with one road. And so the word of an abutting road is directly correlated with the facts in those cases, in abutting road, there only was one road, in Lanier and in Lindley. And therefore, for those reasons, the word of an abutting road does not mean that any abutting road that is extinguished is compensable, especially when the city passes a regulation or is acting within its police power. There was no project, there was no taking, there was no fee taking here. Lanier Farm and the facts and those properties with the frontage of just one public street. And also, with the other facts of this case, it's important to look at the pleading and see that there was no allegation of unreasonable access. And although there may have been an allegation of a damage to the property in the complaint, which is actually an element, the court had to look at the overall pleadings and determine, under the line of cases of Dennison and Easley and Lindley, whether or not Hook Group had pled that there was unreasonable access, and they did not. They did not
plead. Your time has expired. Thank you for
your
argument.
And for those reasons, Your Honor, we would ask you to affirm the trial court.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Emmert, if you have rebuttal, you have 12 minutes and 35 seconds remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't plan to use it all. I'll address a few of the points that Ms. Berggren raised, starting with her reliance on Wood. As we pointed out in the reply brief, Wood isn't even an eminent domain case. It was an injunction case in which the landowner had received essentially a license from the city that was revocable at will. So that's not going to get as far as the city would like to take it. Ms. Berggren described the proposed commercial development of the property here and said that the council had to strike a balance between the effect on the neighborhood and the effect on this property. While that may be correct, it's analytically immaterial to the issue here, which is when in taking an easement of access, did they damage the property? Now, Mr. Justice Mims was correct in asking about the effect of the pleadings. In paragraph 32, we specifically asserted that this had a deleterious effect, excuse me, a substantial negative effect on the value of the property and on its highest and best use. As we indicated in the reply brief, the property now can't be developed as much because it doesn't have a second entrance, which it did before this action by the city. Ms. Berggren also gave what I'll call the floodgates argument that
council,
claims all over.
Council.
Yes.
This is Justice Mims again.
Yes.
What about hypothetically other actions of the city, a comprehensive plan amendment, a zoning ordinance amendment, that would have an equal impairment of development potential? Would those be subject to an inverse condemnation or any other action by a landowner?
Now, you're asking me to delve into the swimming pool of land use, which is always a dangerous thing, but I'll try. If there is a change in some kind of zoning or planning ordinance, then any predated use of the property or available use of the property, I think, is grandfathered. So if the city were to claim now that a new land use regulation were to cut off the previously available use, then I believe the answer is yes, that would be a compensable action.
I think we would actually have to have an overlay of vested rights analysis to get to that point. I guess what I'm saying is this. I understand the context of your pleadings. I understand the context of a city action taking away road access. But there's all sorts of things that cities do in the normal course of events, and particularly with regard that may add value or take value away from a potential development that has not, where the rights have not yet vested. And I'm struggling with which ones of those are potentially compensable or potentially actionable under this new constitutional regime. Give me some guidance there.
Well, I'll do the best I can. If there is a change in some kind of applicable ordinance that affects the ability of a property to be developed in a matter that has vested, let's just say it's by right development. It may still have to go through site plan analysis, but the development is by right. And I don't think that the city can, without incurring inverse condemnation liability, take away the rights to do that, take away the rights that have vested to be able to develop land in a certain way. What this action did was, under the city's existing ordinances, it deprived us of a by right development of the property because it was served by two roads. So I'm not going to be able to anticipate every possible example and every possible circumstance, which I know you have the challenge to do in forming an opinion. But in this case, it should be abundantly clear that the action the city took, while it is certainly is a police power argument or a police power action, I readily acknowledge that. But it goes beyond a pure exercise of the police power and affects a taking, just as it did in Lindsley, just as it did in Denison. When a police power exercise goes too far and takes away property rights, that's a compensable act. I'd also want to address Ms. Berggren's statement that we didn't plead unreasonable
Mr.
access.
Emmett, this is Justice Kelsey. May I follow up on that last point?
Sure.
Of course, the police power is the predicate power of a local government in this context, and you're quite right. I would concede that it's a matter of degree, not a matter of kind. But the case law is, I think, pretty clear that it's a reasonableness test. the new statutes in the 2012 amendment to our Constitution changes the wording to a material impairment. Is there a distinction in your mind between a reasonable use of the police power for which there would be no taking compensation whatsoever and an immaterial impairment use of the police power, in which case there'd be no compensation owed, there'd be no taking?
I sense that the pre-existing case law before 2012 dealt with the reasonableness of access, whereas the new law, the new constitutional provision and statutes, expand the compensability to say that now a diminution in material access is compensable even if reasonable access remains. So I think that the case law did change, or the law did change effectively on that. The law is now stronger.
When I read your complaint, in all candor, I read it the way the appellee read it, which is you're really just saying there was, in fact, a property interest. The property interest was, in fact, taken away, ergo taking, as if the police power didn't even exist in the equation. Whether that becomes a pleading issue and a proof issue, I don't know. But where did you make it clear to the trial court that this is truly a matter of degree, not a matter of kind, and it needs to go to a jury of commissioners, or actually just a jury?
In this case, a jury. I'll start with paragraphs 32 and 33 of the complaint on page 6 of the appendix, where we set out what the deprivation of the rights meant for this property, and that it was for a public use, and it was within the protections of Article 1, Section 11. As it existed at the time of this suit was filed in 2017, that included the new language of the statutes and the Constitution. So the answer is, we alleged in there a complete extinguishment of all access, and we had the burden to prove at the ensuing trial that we've had a material change in access, and if you want to use the old case law, that we have unreasonable access afterward. But that's a proof matter. It's not a pleading matter. We've made all the allegations that we have to make under the notice pleading to let the city know these are the actions that you've taken that we're complaining about, and this is the relief that we want.
My last question, Mr. Emmert. The legislature in 25.1-100 and 230.1, when you put those together, you get the sense that they're really just talking about direct access, the impairment to direct access. Not the diminution in value to the property generally because of a loss of some access, but the presence or absence of direct access. So obviously this property has direct access to Battlefield Boulevard. If you got to a jury, what jury instruction would you be asking for? And how in the world could you produce enough evidence to say that the access to Battlefield Boulevard is not direct access?
I wouldn't presume to say that the access to Battlefield Boulevard is the determining factor. It's cutting off all access that we had to Callison Drive, and did that materially affect the access to the property? And in this case, it's yes, as we've pleaded. A second entrance is a vitally valuable amenity for any commercial property.
Counsel?
Yes.
I certainly would agree on certain fact patterns about second access, particularly if it's, let's say, you've got a corner property with access onto two commercial roads. As I understand it, Callison is essentially a stub that then allows somebody to leave your property, get onto the stub, drive through a residential neighborhood, and then eventually get back to Battlefield Boulevard. Is this really an impairment of access, or does this really just boil down to I can develop at a higher density with two access points than I can develop with one access point?
It is both. The first and most obvious answer is that the city's land use ordinances permit us a higher development density with two access points. The second, though, is that with and we would have to prove this at trial, that with a second entrance, a delivery driver, for example, wouldn't have to be elbowing aside customers in order to get to the back of the property to make deliveries. I don't anticipate a stream of trucks.
That delivery driver is going to have a whole lot of angry residents, I'm guessing.
If they're not too frequent, I suppose not. But the point is, that is a right that was appurtenant to that property at the time of this legislative action by the City Council. And so that's a right that was taken away. We've alleged that they extinguished all direct access to Callison, and that question of whether remaining access is reasonable belongs to a jury.
Mr. Emmert, this is Justice Kelsey again, but that's not what the statutes say that were enacted in response to the constitutional change. It's not direct access to the secondary road, it's direct access to the property. And I think that one logical flaw is your Achilles heel.
I'm always interested in hearing what my Achilles heel is so I can try to respond to it. As far as direct access to the property is concerned, that considers access points from all around. Now, but we've lost all access to a street, and that street is Callison Drive, and it was, as we pointed out in our reply brief, a major street in our development plans. So in that context, I think we're saying the same thing, but approaching it from a different angle doesn't change the analysis, in my opinion. Well, this will end my now two-day experience of arguing blind. I appreciate your patience in listening to me today, and I look forward to the day soon when I can return to the lectern in Richmond. Hope you all have a good day.
All right, thank you very much. The clerk will call the next case.